This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for June 24th, 2013. Let's quickly review the items we've selected for this week's program. First, an internal legal memorandum in which the IRS, in an 11-page memo, dissects a failed plan by an S corporation to contribute assets to a partnership and have those assets sold by the partnership while remaining liable for the partnership liabilities in an attempt to avoid the built-in gain tax. Then a misleading headnote, which says cash settlement payment won't be treated as other than voting stock, but the facts are unique. The headnote doesn't say anything about the facts being unique. Then a fairly common ruling, subsidiaries, the first year they're included in a consolidated return, they were listed on the Form 851. They forgot to file the Forms 1122. We'll talk about how that gets solved. Then a non-farmer, a retired college professor who bought some cropland up in South Dakota and put it in the CRP program, is found to be liable for the self-employment tax because of all the things he had to do to participate in the CRP program. Then a large business and international division memorandum instructing agents for the procedures before they actually issue an information document request. So the IDR is going to be made much less burdensome, issue-oriented and less burdensome. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then the Thousand Oaks residential care case we talked about in this program several months ago, in which the taxpayers essentially prevailed, but they didn't have a complete victory, and the court has denied them a recovery of fees. Next, an IRS analysis on that reports positive results from return preparer oversight. I think we'll all be interested in those statistics. And then finally, the IRS provides information on your professional responsibility for foreign bank account reporting and what you are supposed to do to make sure that you and your client have a clear understanding about whether the client has a foreign bank account. It's not a whole lot to talk about, but it certainly is enough. So let's begin with Internal Legal Memorandum 2013-24013. And the headnote here says, indemnity of a partnership's indebtedness should be ignored. This is a long, detailed, complex analysis, but the essence is, there was a complex plan to avoid the built-in gain tax by an S corporation forming a qualified S subsidiary, contributing the assets of the Q sub to a partnership while the parent guaranteed the partnership debt in a leverage to make this a leveraged partnership transaction. The IRS ruled that the indemnity was illusory. The transaction was clearly set up to be unwound after 10 years and one day. It was a device to avoid the tax under Code Section 1374. This is another lesson in that no matter how clever you are, you may find that your cleverness doesn't work for you in designing transactions to avoid tax. Several aspects of the transaction were unusual and designed for a tax rather than a business purpose. So the IRS recommends to the field agent who's auditing this deal that the transaction should be treated as one in which the parent company borrows from a bank to buy a percentage of the contributed assets and then forms a partnership, which would have triggered built-in gain. Or the IRS, you could disregard the contribution and distribution form of the transaction, treat it as a sale or exchange of a percentage of the contributed assets under the judicial doctrine of substance over form. In any event, the built-in gain is going to be recognized, not avoided. Next, a lesson in the fact that headnotes can be deceiving. This is Letter Ruling 2013-24003. The headnote says, cash settlement payment won't be treated as other than voting stock. It goes on to say, a foreign corporation's payment of a cash settlement amount to former shareholders of a U.S. company that the corporation acquired in a 368A1C reorg won't be considered a payment of other than voting stock that would cause the acquisition to fail to be a valid reorg. So this ruling relates only to the validity of the reorganization and the effect of what happened after the initial acquisition on the validity of the reorg. Here are the facts. Pursuant to the merger agreement, a percentage of stock of the acquiring corporation was left in escrow, providing the sole remedy for indemnification for any breaches in the target's representations, warranties, and covenants. Prior to the acquisition, the target corporation had initiated a lawsuit arising from a commercial dispute. Under the terms of the merger agreement, if Target prevailed, any recovery would be the property of the acquiring corporation, and the Target shareholders would be entitled to an early release of shares from the escrow account in the amount that the acquirer recovered in cash. If Target lost, that is, there was no recovery, nothing changed between the acquirer and Target. Target had no duty to furnish additional consideration, and the parties would not adjust the purchase price. So the Target shareholders pursued the plaintiff litigation on a contingent fee basis. In year two, the parties settled, agreeing that the defendant would pay the acquirer X dollars, which the defendant did. The firm deducted its contingent fee. The acquirer ordered the escrow account to release to the Target shareholders a number of shares equal to the settlement amount. Then the Target sought to recover from the escrow account reimbursement for its contingent fee, asserting that the contingent attorney's fees caused it to suffer an indemnifiable loss under the merger agreement. But wait a second. There was no loss. If the Target had lost, nothing would have changed. They won. So the contingent fees were not a loss or an expense to the acquiring corporation. So in year three, the Target shareholders sued the acquirer because the acquirer had taken value out of the escrow account, and the acquirer settled by giving them in cash the value of the shares. So you can see how there was no cash payment in lieu of stock. There was a cash payment satisfying the liability for stock that was acquired subsequent to the merger. Don't trust the headnote. Read the whole thing. Next, in Letter Ruling 2013-24010, an accounting firm failed to properly prepare a consolidated return, including the first return with two new subsidiaries. The new subsidiaries were included on the Form 851 affiliation schedule, but the accounting firm did not include Forms 1122 in the consolidated return, which is a breach of the rules. So when the IRS was auditing this return, they discover that there are no Forms 1122. Is it too late? No. In this, obviously, you request a private letter ruling, you pay the user fee, you pay the professional fees for preparing the ruling, and the IRS ruled that each of the three subsidiaries will be treated as having joined in the filing of a consolidated return with their common parent, and that ruling is under the authority of Regulation 1.1502-75B2, which permits the Commissioner of Internal Revenue to accept a corporation in a consolidated return where basically you've just got a foot fault, which is the failure to file the Form 1122. The lesson here is that accounting firms need to be more careful, should have been more careful. And I think this gets to the question of competence. If you don't know what you're doing with consolidated returns, you ought not to accept the engagement. So I wonder who paid the fee. I wonder who paid the user fee, who paid to have the private letter ruling request. I'd be willing to bet that the professional liability insurer was involved in there someplace. Next, a tax court decision, 140 TC number 16, Rollin J. Morehouse. Mr. Morehouse is found to be liable for self-employment taxes for CRP payments for land he owned in South Dakota. He did not live on the land. He did not farm the land. But pursuant to the contracts, he was responsible to carry out a conservation plan. Now, he hired a retired farmer to help him meet the obligations, but he still had a lot of things that he was responsible for. The use of the term rental in the CRP contract did not mean that the federal government was going to use Mr. Morehouse's land. The use of the land remained with Mr. Morehouse. He was being compensated for his use of the land, not receiving rent for someone else to use the land. How did Mr. Morehouse use the land? Well, he used the land. He performed all the necessary things he had to do in order to receive the CRP payment. If he plowed the land and planted corn and harvested the corn, he would sell the corn. But he took care of the land in accordance with the conservation program, and he got the CRP payments, and they are self-employment income. The obligations that Mr. Morehouse accepted included maintaining already established grass and cover for the life of the contract, established perennial vegetative cover on land temporarily removed from agricultural production, including pubescent or intermediate wheat grass, alfalfa, and sweet clover, engage in pest control and pesticide management for the life of the contract, and to control pests such as weeds, livestock, insects, and disease, establish adapted native perennial vegetative cover, including western wheatgrass, green needlegrass, and alfalfa. When the work was completed, Mr. Morehouse was required to provide to the CCC a report of performance and submit receipts and seed tags. So he was clearly engaged in doing work in order to get the CRP payments. That means they are self-employment income. Next, we have Large Business and International Division Memorandum 04-0613-004. This memorandum announces that all information document requests issued after June 30, 2013 must be, number one, issue-focused, number two, discussed with the taxpayer, and number three, provide a reasonable deadline for response. Large Business and International Examiners and Specialists are provided several actions that must be performed in issuing information document requests. The examiner must identify and state the issue that led the examiner to request the information included in the IDR. Then, before issuing the IDR, the examiner must discuss it with the taxpayer, and both parties determine a reasonable time for response. The directive also provides that any current memoranda of understanding on IDR management that don't comply with the new training requirements are no longer effective. Now, this is for the Large Business and International Division. If you are a sole proprietorship or a small business, this rule doesn't apply to you. So you're probably going to continue to get the shotgun approach information document request. However, if you receive such a document request, I strongly recommend that you attempt to limit the scope of the document request by encouraging the agent to participate in a pre-audit conference, much like that is mandated for large business and international cases, in order to make the audit more efficient. I just did that in an examination that I originally thought was going to take 3 or 4 days, but by agreeing with the agent on what was going to be audited and why the return had been selected for audit, we were able to get information together, and the exam took 4 hours, not 3 days. So I recommend this, what I would call a cooperative approach. Next, in Thousand Oaks Residential Care Home, Inc., the tax court has found the IRS position was justified and denied a corporation its litigation costs. The result in this case, it was a mixed result. The taxpayers didn't walk away scot-free, and the IRS didn't get everything they asked for. The court, in the discussion, says whether compensation was reasonable is necessarily a question of facts and circumstances. In this case, the court required a full trial, complete with expert witnesses on both sides, in order to make a determination, looking at a number of factors that relate to whether compensation is reasonable. So, because the matter required a full trial, and the IRS won a partial victory, the taxpayers do not recover their fees. Next, this is an IRS analysis of the results of their own return preparer oversight, and I think everyone's going to find this interesting. I want to review the statistics. The IRS reports that as a result of their return preparer oversight that began in 2004, there is a long-term reduction in the number of preparers, increased standardization, and fewer errors on returns. Let's begin with the number of preparers by processing year. In 2004, there were 1.3 million preparers. In 2012, 800,000. In 2004, the number of prepared returns and the number of returns per preparer began at about 50, 60 million returns. By 2012, we were up to almost twice the number of prepared returns. but the number of returns per preparer had remained fairly constant. The share of preparers for select processing years by market segment, in 2004, 66% of returns were prepared by those persons who prepared between 1 and 20 returns, 17% by those who prepared 21 to 100, and 17% by those who prepared more than 100. By 2012, the percentage of returns prepared by those who prepared between 1 and 20 returns had dropped to 40%, and the number of returns, let's just take those who prepare more than 100 returns, was up to 30% of all returns filed by preparers. The share of returns prepared for select processing years by market segment is important because by 2012, 88% of prepared returns are being prepared by preparers who prepare more than 100 returns. The number of preparers who stay with the preparer business has also been steadily declining, from 1.3 million in 2004 to fewer than 800,000, as I mentioned earlier, and new preparers who come into the preparation business are not staying. So those who've been in it a while are leaving, and their numbers are not being replaced by new preparers. The percentage of preparers that held a PTIN in 2012, 98% of those who prepared more than 100 returns held PTINs. Those who prepared 1 to 20 returns, only 44% held PTINs. Math error rates by preparation and submission method for the most recent year tested, hand-prepared, paper-submitted returns accounted for 37% of hand-prepared, paper-submitted returns contained math errors, while only 5.3% of software-prepared, paper-submitted returns contained errors, and 1.1% of software-prepared emailed returns contained math errors. So it's pretty clear that the use of technology and the regulation of preparers is making the IRS's job of processing, analyzing, and processing our tax returns much easier. Finally, and this may be the most important item that we cover today, the IRS has provided information on your responsibility for your client's filing of foreign bank account reports. There is posted to the IRS website information about your responsibility to make sure that you get the information from your client, assuring that you will prepare, if necessary, the form TDF 90-22.1. The IRS says that practitioners have a duty under Circular 230 to ask their clients enough questions to prepare correct responses to the foreign bank and financial account questions on Form 1040, Form 1065, or Form 1120. The level of due diligence is addressed in Circular 230, Section 10.22, and also in Section 10.34, Subsection D of the practice standards. There, that states that a practitioner may generally rely in good faith and without verification on information furnished by a client. However, good faith reliance contemplates that a practitioner will make reasonable inquiries when a client provides information that implies possible participation in overseas transactions and accounts subject to the foreign bank account reporting requirements. The document posted on the IRS website provides additional details on the topic, a link to an IRS list of frequently asked questions, and an email address to ask additional questions. But the bottom line is, we have an ethical responsibility, because Circular 230, after all, is about ethical tax practice. We have an ethical responsibility to ask enough questions to determine whether our client, who may have a home in Mexico or a home in Canada, or who may take extended vacations in foreign countries, we really need to press the issue as to whether there is a bank account in that foreign country. Failure to do so doesn't just cause problems potentially for the client, it obviously is going to cause problems for the practitioner. So you have a responsibility under Circular 230, Section 10.22, the due diligence standard, to press your client to assure yourself that they either do or they don't have a foreign bank account. Well, thanks again for joining me this week. Meanwhile, stay safe, and we'll see you next week.